From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Obama mania is becoming a global phenomenon. Here in the U.S., we're still reacting to the news that Barack Obama is set to become the Democratic nominee for president. But from Canada to Latin America, across the Atlantic and Pacific, millions of people have been tracking one of the most interesting U.S. presidential races in history. Today, we'll see how blacks in Europe are reacting to the news. In a few minutes, we'll talk to a U.S.-born jazz singer who's lived in Germany for 26 years. But first, we have Diane Abbott. In 1987, she became the first black woman elected to British Parliament. She represents Hackney North and Stoke Newington within Greater London. Diane, it's great to talk to you.
Hi, Farai.
So you've been watching this election closely. It's historic. What strikes you in addition to race?
One of the things that strikes me is that it's not frequently remarked that actually Obama just fought and organized a better campaign than Hillary. I mean, sometimes you get the impression he was swept in on a tide of rhetoric, but he seemed to, his team appeared to have understood the caucus system better. They raised many more sums of money, millions than her, through using the internet in a really innovative way. It was just technically a better campaign.
Now, what's the consensus, if there is any, about what Obama means for politics, not just in the U.S., but across the world?
Well, I think partly what's interesting is the way he has used the internet to raise money, but also bring in a whole new generation of voters. I also think that, particularly after the Bush years, internationally, we believe an Obama presidency really will be turning the page for America in a way that, sadly, Hillary would not have been. I think that people of color, we think that having, I mean, potentially a black man as leader of the free world will make white people everywhere see people of color everywhere differently. It can't help but achieve that. But also, as the mother of a 16-year-old black man, I think that mothers everywhere from, you know, in England, in Africa, in the Caribbean, I think mothers of black boys everywhere, the day that Obama actually stands on the steps of the Capitol and is inaugurated, you know, we will be able to point to our boy children and say, look, see, that somebody like you, and he is leader of the free world. I think it'll be an extraordinary event for people of color internationally.
You sound pretty confident he's going to get elected.
Well, I mean, I realize it's a big call. It's going to be harder for Barack Obama to get elected from the electorate at large than it was from the Democratic faithful. But I think that if he runs an effective campaign, if he does what he did within the Democratic primaries, which is mobilize, you know, black Americans, younger Americans, and bring over independents, I think the worst thing that can happen is that he loses, but loses narrowly. And, you know, I believe that even if he loses this race, as long as he fights a good race, and I'm sure he will come out an immensely strong figure in the Democratic Party. He's got this massive fundraising machine. He's going to help hundreds of down-ticket Democrats win. He's still in his 40s. Win or lose, Obama is going to be a big figure in U.S. politics for years going forward.
Now, black Brits are a significant part of the population in the U.K.'s major cities, still a much smaller population in terms of race than black Americans. So you were the first black woman elected to Parliament in the U.K., and it wasn't really that long ago. So do you think the U.K. is ready to elect a black person to the top office of the land?
No, we're not. It's very interesting. America, for all its issues, has raced ahead of the rest of the free world. And what it tells you is that America's perfect union for all its imperfections, for all the endemic racism and classism, really. As Obama himself often says in his speeches, nowhere else in the world is his story even possible.
Now, you're someone who's of Jamaican descent, though born in the UK. Obama certainly has an immigrant story of his own, which he told in his book. Do you think it also has a reverb around the story of immigrants and the children of immigrants?
Fantastically so. I mean, I write for newspapers in Jamaica, and they are just enthralled with this race because this is a story of a man whose father came from millions of miles away to achieve high office. And it's a story for immigrants, whatever their color. In some ways, it's really quite a romantic story, and it's amazing how people identify with it.
How do you think the press in England has been treating this race in the U.S.?
Well, the British press has been very interesting. The British press has been very interested. But I think one of the things about the Obama race is for white people and white commentators, it's been sometimes tricky to get their heads round. Like, for instance, right at the beginning, there were white commentators saying stuff like, well, you know, he's whinging about racism. How can he be whinging about racism? When it was very clear that, you know, the race card was being played by spoofs of Hillary Clinton. So there were white commentators who were willing to believe the worst about Obama. And I'm willing to understand what I understand, because it happened to me when I was first elected 20 years ago, the fantastic, unreasoning bitterness of white supporters of a white candidate when they are defeated by a young black person. I have an inkling of what Obama is now facing some Hillary supporters, because I had it. Some of my white, I defeated a white incumbent in a primary, and some of his supporters have not forgiven me to this day. They just could not believe a young black person could do that to their hero. So, but having said that, overall, the British press have been fascinated by the race.
Well, Diane, it's great to have you on and great to get the update. Thank you.
Great to talk to you.
Diane Abbott is a member of British Parliament, and she joined us from her home in London. And there are plenty of black folks born in Europe, but there are also expats, Americans who have long made their lives abroad. And so now we turn to an American citizen who has spent the last 26 years living in Germany. Lillian Boutte is an educator and singer who tours Europe performing New Orleans-style jazz, gospel, and R&B. Lillian, how are you?
Hi, Farad. Wonderful. Thank you for having me on.
So how'd you end up moving to Europe?
Well, in 1980, I met a very fine young clarinet player. He was playing in the theater that I was performing in New Orleans, and he happened to be German. And it was a complete little European band sitting in this foyer playing. And we became friends, the whole band. We all became friends, and I had been coming over already to Europe. And I came over one time in 82, and I toured with Thomas, and we toured together, and we talked about putting the band together. In 1983, put it in God's hands, packed up, and came over, and we married in 1984. And I've been working, and I thank God for every day, all my work, and the places that I've been going to. So he was one of my main reasons. I'm very glad that, you know, he came into my life, because I don't know if I would have just come just on my own.
26 years is a long, long time. So when you think about that much of your life being in Germany, are you now an expert on America to your German friends? I mean, do they ask you about the political race?
Oh, honey, I'm a target, you know, because my thing is that I'm a musician, and the thing that I come from New Orleans, where the jazz, we say jazz was born, but the only culture that we gave to the world is the jazz music. If you know, I mean, I always tell people, Google it. So when I'm on stage, I have almost like a little platform, because how can I not say something when I know how terrible things are really going? I don't try to delve on it, you know, but I do mention it. I always mention it, what's going on. So for me, I've been kind of like politically inclined for a long time. But by my friends knowing that I came from, of all places, New Orleans, there's such a great focus on the city itself, not because of Katrina, before that, since Louis Armstrong and all the other greats, you know, that they come to me and they want to know. And I'm one of 10 kids. I'm one of 10. My mom has 10. My mom and dad had 10. My dad is gone, but my mom is still there. And we were always filled in with everything. My dad was in the Second War. My dad had he had been hurt in that war, but they taught us. We went to school. We learned, and we've been, you know, when the Vietnam War came, you know, I'm 58. I'll be 59 in August. You know, I was on the steps with my black armband and my hand in the air, because all of the young men that went out of the school with me, half of them actually came back in body bags.
Well, Lillian,
from Vietnam.
We have to wrap up, but before we let you go, what are people saying, both black Germans, because there are some, and white Germans?
Well, I tell you something. In Germany, I would say in all the places that I've been going to for the last years, and especially now since the campaign has been going on, the people are looking for something fresh. I think that the world is looking for something fresh. And I don't think that they're afraid of Obama because he's black. They may be very confused that he did win this primary. He did win this primary. But if you're standing on the outside and looking in and listening to what this beautiful young man is saying, he's saying things that people need to hear. But he's saying things that people want to hear, and he's saying things that we need for it to happen. So the countries that I'm going into, yes, they would love to see the promises that he's making all to come true. And I believe that he can do it. And I think that they think he can do it also.
We have to let you go, but thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much.
Lillian Boutte is an American citizen who's lived in Germany since 1983. Just ahead, making your kids' summer safe and spectacular. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. No more pencils, no more books, no more teachers' dirty looks. Do you remember that ode to the start of summer? Well, kids are running for the parks, the pools, and video games now that schools are wrapping up. But parents can find that the summer brings headaches as well as joys. What do you do if you're working full-time and your kids are young? And what if you don't have a lot of money for fancy summer camps? Carol Brunson Day is president and CEO of the National Black Child Development Institute. She's got some tips for us. Hi, Carol. Carol, let's break down what parents are facing. If you're a working parent, how can you go about finding the right camp or summer program for your kid? I mean, it's a situation where many times, and I'll just tell a story for myself. I grew up in Baltimore and absolutely loved it. I grew up on a street where there was, it was perfectly safe to ride your bike and all that, but there weren't a lot of kids around. So what I found happening was that I would be out on my bike with my sister. We didn't have a lot of people who were around as kids, and so we went to summer camps, and we relied a lot of times on the free or reduced summer camps. So first of all, Carol, how are things going in terms of there being free or reduced summer camps?
I think that the situation probably varies from city to city, but there are many opportunities for free and reduced summer camp activities through organizations like the YMCAs, YWCAs, Boys and Girls Club, etc. Boys and Girls Clubs.
So how do parents go about finding about programs that aren't going to break the bank?
I think parents can make inquiries at the school where their child attends. That would be my first suggestion. Usually school systems are well aware of the fact that children, of course, are out during the summer, and they're interested in children being involved in productive and safe activities during the summer. So they often will have information for parents, particularly about municipal services that offer camps and fun and educational experiences during the summer. I think also the television and radio are opportunities for parents to find out about activities, just keeping their eyes open and watching what's being advertised. Sometimes other media forms also provide information, billboards on buses and in areas you know, that the public often attends, posters, for example, that may be obvious in City Hall and, you know, other kinds of public places. And then I would say newspapers are another source of information about summer events available for children.
Let me turn to the issue, Carol, of two different scenarios. One is you're working during the summer as a parent. The other one is that you're home. So let's start with some of the stay-at-home parents. It might be easier to say, okay, my schedule's flexible, but they might also drive you crazy. So what kind of plans can you make that keep everybody happy?
Well, I think stay-at-home parents may have an opportunity or an advantage, if you will, in that their time is more available to their children. But I think the important thing to remember about summer is we know that children lose a lot of the academic gains that they make during the school year during the summer if they are not engaged in activities that keep their minds active. So it's not just a question of driving parents crazy, but stay-at-home parents also need to be looking for productive activities for their children during the summer.
Okay, if you're working, say that you have found a situation for your kid that you feel is healthy, but then someone calls and says, I'm sorry, your child is sick, we can't keep sick children here. What kind of backup plans do you need?
Well, I think the backup plans one needs during the summer are the same as backup plans one needs during the year. Somebody is going to have to stay home with a sick child, particularly if the child is, spreading the disease or illness that he or she has. And so there are babysitters. There are often in the summer, there are other family members, teenagers or young adults, teenagers particularly, who would normally be in school but are available during the summer.
Well, what about teens? Because, you know, teens are at this age where you can leave them by themselves, but you may not always like what they're doing. How do you deal with that?
Well, teens need productive activities scheduled for them during the summer, just like younger children. I think that they, of course, will want more autonomy and should participate in the planning of events. But I strongly recommend that parents sit down with their teens and make plans for how they will spend their time during the summer.
What about jobs? Is there, you know, it's a tight economy. What if a teen was counting on getting a job and they're finding it harder than they thought? How do you deal with that disappointment and maybe steer them in other directions?
Well, I think teens can be encouraged to look at volunteer activities, even if they don't pay a salary, because those require the same kinds of commitments. They require responsibility and accountability. And they are opportunities for teens to learn skills, acquire skills, and or pursue areas of interest that they may well have. So they can be really a suitable substitute, if you will, for employment.
Well, Carol, great to talk to you. Thanks. Carol Brunson Day is the president and CEO of the National Black Child Development Institute. And now we're going to take a closer look at summer camps. We have Kevin Gordon, director of Camp Kupagani. It's a multicultural girls camp outside of Chicago. And Shade Thomas from Camp Atwater, the oldest African-American-owned camp in America. Hi, folks.
Hello.
Hello.
So, Kevin, let me start with you. Summer camp can be a place where kids learn a lot about themselves and others. Sometimes kids can also find it frightening or they get lonely. So what are the benefits of going to summer camp?
Well, there's a number of benefits. You know, camp helps increase personal accountability, their decision-making, social skills, appreciation of natural surroundings. They get to make new friends, know campers who are different from themselves, feel good about themselves. There's just a whole array of things that they can't necessarily get in school or other social settings that they can get in the camp setting.
And your camp is only for girls. Why is that important?
We feel that it's, you know, because children get, you know, the co-ed atmosphere in school and in social, you know, for 50 weeks out of the year. We have a two-week program. So we feel that, you know, with having girls only for that time, we get a chance to work on girl-specific things without the distractions of, you know, having to feel that you might have to impress the boys or things like that. So you get, you know, girls can be girls and get that great empowerment in that setting.
What's the age range?
Our camp is seven girls aged 7 to 15.
And how do you break them up? In terms of groups by age?
We have three different groupings. We group in their cabin, the cabin setting, their living group. It's pretty narrowly by age, so 10-year-olds are with only 10-year-olds. We also have teams and sharing groups that they get to work on different communication skills, identity pieces, multicultural pieces. Those are a little bit broader, so you could have an 8-year-old with a 10-year-old with a 12-year-old in a group of about 10 to 12 girls. And then we also have our table grouping in the dining hall, which is the broadest age group. So you can have 8-year-olds with a 15-year-old because they're, you know, everyone gets to be a whole, you know, camp family and community.
Sade, let me turn to you. So Camp Atwater sounds like it has a long storied history. Tell me a little bit about that.
Camp Atwater was founded and started in 1921. And at that time, it was probably the only black camp in the country. So families sent from all around the country sent their campers to Camp Atwater. My parents, my grandparents all attended Camp Atwater. And even to this day, we have third and fourth generation campers coming to Camp Atwater. There was a break during the 80s, and then the Springfield Urban League, who owns and operates Camp Atwater, reopened the camp, and we've been going strong ever since.
Now, you're someone who had the experience of being a camper, and now you're running the show. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your experiences as a girl and then how you stayed with Camp Atwater.
I had wonderful experiences throughout Camp Atwater. It is a second home to me. Being in an environment sometimes where I didn't see my culture reflected and being in the minority, it was a great space for me to go in the summer and see other girls who look like me, had the same hair as me, and just really a space where I was validated as a young African-American girl. And then on top of that, being in that space, the mentorship that my counselors provide and just seeing them walking around with their college sweatshirts inspired me to what I would go on to do in my future. And then all the activities that they provided, it was just a great outlet for me as I was developing my own skills as a young person.
So if you had to sum up what it was that you got that you have still got today in like a sentence or two, what did this experience give you?
I would say more than anything, it gave me leadership and self-confidence. Self-confidence in knowing that there are tons of talented African-American women who go on to do amazing things, and that served as inspiration for me and what I would go on to do. But it also provided me a space where I could try leadership roles and new experiences, and that translated into my academic life, into my social life. But it all started at Camp Atwater.
Now, Kevin, what about homesickness? There, you know, when you talk about, you know, stay away camp or overnight camp, you can also see that some of the kids, and probably kids of all ages, might miss their parents. What do you do when a camper, you know, says, I want to go home?
Homesickness is, not to diminish it, but it's a natural, we call it more of a transition issue. It's a natural part of going away or you know, becoming more independent. Just for our girls, you know, if you love your family, you love your home, you should miss elements of it. So what we do is that, and a lot of good camps do, is you know, you're just always aware of that. And there are times when, you know, those transition issues or that homesickness are strongest. Those tend to be more downtime. So we give the campers the tools to learn when they're feeling down, and they stay busy, they're making new friends. So it's really about getting the tools to manage that. For some girls, it might be a minute on the third day, and that's it. For some girls, it might be it might be a little longer for a couple days. But as they figure out how to manage that, and we help them with that, they grow out of that and they get that more independence.
Sade, what do you do with out of control parents, or at least parents who are needy? Because from what I've heard, there are some parents who might say, well, my kid said this, or why don't you do this, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Everybody's got a complaint or at least an opinion. What do you do if those opinions become intrusive?
We do a great job of just making sure the lines of communication are always open. I have parents who drop their kids off on Saturday and we never hear from them, and then parents who constantly call the office. And it's basically fielding those questions and making them feel comfortable that their children are in good hands. And we try to do that with having a comprehensive parent orientation. So those questions that they would be inclined to ask throughout the summer, we try to answer everything up front to really eliminate those needy parents and constant calling. Although it happens, we do always have the lines open for communication.
Kevin, how would you describe what you have as a, you have a multicultural camp, but that can mean a lot of different things. What do you really mean in terms of how you execute your mission?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
How do you use the concept of multiculturalism in your work, very specifically with the kids?
We have a number of different, we have a 12-day curriculum that beginning from the first full day and going throughout the 2 weeks, we start with different activities that address those issues. So it's basically, in a nutshell, we help the girls celebrate their own individual identity while also being comfortable and celebrating those of others, and also giving them the communication skills and the tools to manage any differences that arise.
Sade, what about physical fitness? Do you find that any of the kids end up leaving a little bit more in shape than they were when they came?
Definitely, all the time. Throughout the day, the kids are going. We have certain built-in rest periods, but for the most part, kids are always engaged in activities and active. We make sure that our meals are certified by a nutritionist, fruit and water are on the tables all day. So that's a big part of our mission, and then to make sure that all campers are engaged in that physical, that ongoing physical activity during the day.
Kevin, what about you?
Pretty much the same thing. Camp is a great atmosphere to emphasize the things that they don't necessarily get elsewhere, because they're being active all the time. We're managing their, we're being aware of their food intake, their water intake, and basically it's just a great place to increase awareness of that that aspect of their lives.
All right, Kevin Sade, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kevin Gordon is the director of Camp Coupagani outside of Chicago, and Sade Thomas is the director of Camp Atwater outside Springfield, Massachusetts. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It is time to check in with our own Tony Cox about what's happening in the world of sports. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai.
Now, Tony, the L.A. Lakers have plenty of celebrity fans as well as everyday folks, but their battle against the Boston Celtics in the finals of the NBA tournament takes the excitement to a new level, right?
That is an understatement, if ever there was one. There's a lot of history there, of course, and it's been a long time since we've seen these two marquee teams go head-to-head for the title. But the big question is, who wants it more? And that is one of the subjects on today's Sports Bloggers Roundtable. With us today is D. Will. His blog is Sports on My Mind, and Justin Grant. He writes for the blog Alpha Blog Sports. Gentlemen, welcome.
Hello,
hey, Tony.
So the basketball world got the dream matchup it wanted, and what makes it even more amazing is that when last season ended, nobody would have thought these two teams would be this far in the playoffs, let alone playing each other for the big prize. So let's start with this. Let's talk about personalities, because that's always what makes this series so compelling. And Justin, we'll take one team at a time. On the Lakers side, you've got Kobe Bryant, who people either love or hate. He's got three rings, but none since the halcyon days with Shaquille O'Neal. Now, he's playing this season like he's never won anything. What's his motivation?
Well, I guess to Kobe Bryant, his mindset is he really hasn't won anything. I think those three rings that he won with Shaq are out the window here. For Kobe, this is more than just about winning the ring. I think this is an opportunity for him to join the pantheon, to really carve his name in stone next to Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson and Bill Russell and Wilt Chamberlain and those guys. And the scary thing about it for the rest of Kobe Bryant's contemporaries is he's at that same place that Michael Jordan was at back in 1991, that place where his physical abilities started to match up with his mental abilities. And that's a real scary proposition for the rest of the league. I think Kobe really understands that his legacy is on the line here. Obviously, Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce and those guys are playing for a legacy as well. But I think for Kobe Bryant, he understands that his place in history is really at stake here in this series.
Let's talk about one more part of the Lakers before we go on to Boston, D. Will. And that's the coach, okay. Phil Jackson, who is tied with Boston's legendary Red Auerbach. They each have 9 titles. Jackson can rewrite history with a victory. That's got to be a motivator for him.
Absolutely. Phil has talked about the 10th championship a while ago. However, it's very interesting that he's playing some kind of mind games and downplaying it, actually, this championship go-around. He has also brought up the ghosts of Red Auerbach, and I think that that's a jab at both Red and the NBA to keep the referees off the Lakers. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens and how Phil reacts should the Lakers win.
On the other hand, as you mentioned already, Justin, in Boston, you've got the big three. Kevin Garnett, the league's top defensive player, spent 11 long years going nowhere with the Minnesota Timberwolves. Paul Pierce toiled for a decade in Boston without anything positive happening until now. And there's also Ray Allen, another all-star veteran who's never won a ring. You could argue that no one is more motivated than these guys, because this could be their best and last chance for a championship, couldn't it?
It could definitely be their best and last chance. And obviously up in Boston, this is huge right here. This is almost as big as the Red Sox. Well, not quite as big as the Red Sox ending the curse. But it's big for these guys. And it's a real opportunity for them to really, you know, carve their place in Boston lore. For these guys, you know, to get that ring, it's huge. But I think, again, for Kobe Bryant, it's an opportunity to really cement himself, and I really see Kobe Bryant coming out on top here.
What about D-Will? What about Doc Rivers, the coach of the Boston Celtics? Is he underrated? Is he overmatched against Phil Jackson? How responsible do you think he is for the Celtics' success? I know that's 3 questions, but
that's okay. I think Doc is actually underrated as a coach. He's been a very good coach for a very long time. He's a very good players' coach, having been in the NBA like Jackson. He does understand players. He's more recent than Phil also as far as being a player. And he has a very good rapport with his players. He has a great staff, and so he has great X's and O's men around him. It does mean a lot to him because it legitimizes him as well. Danny Ainge took a chance on him and stayed with him through losing seasons, particularly last season, and had the vote of confidence was not a curse. It was actually a blessing. And he is rewarded with the 3 players, or 2 other players, Garnett and Allen, that he has now. And here he is in the NBA Finals.
Game 1 is tonight. Finally, guys, last point on the NBA Finals. Your predictions. Justin Grant, who do you like?
Well, I see the Lakers prevailing in 6 games. I think Phil Jackson, just the mind games he's playing, like D. Will mentioned, with the referees right now. I think the gamesmanship, I think in terms of coaching, they definitely have an edge. At point guard, I think the Lakers definitely have an edge. I look for them to, you know, leave Rajon Rondo alone on the perimeter, make him beat them with his jump shot. And I just don't see Kobe Bryant letting his team down. I don't see him letting his team lose. I see a lot of Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant. And this team has really been dominant throughout the playoffs. They've been able to win on the road, whereas Boston, they seem to shrink when, you know, the crowd is booing them. Obviously, they changed that up against Detroit, but I don't see Kobe letting his team lose this series.
D. Will.
I'm going to go with Boston, even though I'm actually a Lakers and Triangle Offense fan. I think the big three are greater than the big one. And I actually believe that the defense for Boston will actually shut down the offense for L.A. because that's what you have, the best offense versus the best defense.
All right. We don't have to wait long to find out. Let's move on to another topic, though. You might say that the most unusual event of the spring so far was the airing of mixed martial arts on network television. Now, that's usually cable and pay-per-view fare because, let's be honest, it's violent and it has a niche audience. But my guess is that before last week, not many people over the age of 30 had ever heard of MMA. They certainly hadn't seen it. But that may have changed, guys, with the MMA Elite XC event that was broadcast on CBS last Saturday. Kimbo Slice, that's his name, a street brawler turned pro, beat down James Thompson in a grueling, bloody fight that included punches, kicks, wrestling, moves, and it seems everything but the kitchen sink. Little more background really quickly. The ratings were good, but the reviews were mixed. Some said CBS had no business promoting Kimbo Slice when there are more professional fighters around. Some said CBS opened the door and gave legitimacy to a growing sport that was thought to be too brutal for network primetime TV. So, Justin, what about it? You an MMA fan?
Well, I can't call myself an MMA fan. I have been watching a lot of Kimbo's videos on YouTube, and basically this is a guy whose claim to fame is pummeling people in backyards. you know, this sport is legitimate because we in the media say it's legitimate, and it didn't start with CBS. You look at the coverage that ESPN and CNNSI and a lot of the larger newspapers have given this sport. That's what legitimizes it, and there's an appetite for it. And, you know, me personally, I am a fan of the sweet science. I love boxing, and I think that boxing needs to watch out now. They're putting MMA on network television, whereas boxing, if you want to see an unnecessary rematch between Oscar De La Hoya and Floyd Mayweather, you got to pay whatever pay-per-view is demanding. I think, what, $50 or $49.99, something like that?
Yeah.
So, I mean, boxing has to be on the lookout. The hegemony is really pushing this stuff down our throats, and it's on network TV, and it has become legitimate. This is a sport that 10 years ago, I don't even think it was legal in all 50 states.
You're right about that, as a matter of fact.
But there's an appetite for it, and the media has legitimized it.
What do you say, D. Will, about that? Where and when should and will we be able to continue to see this, if that's what you want to see?
Well, I have a feeling that ESPN has something in cahoots with CBS. I found it very odd that ESPN was pushing Kimbo Slice, had him on the cover of their magazine, did specials with him, E60 segments with him, and promoted him for CBS. So I have a feeling that ESPN is about to hop into this feet first, money, or should I say pockets first, and dump a lot of money into MMA. And I think in the near future, that's where we're going to see it most.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like MMA. I don't think it's mixed martial arts. It looks like boxing, kickboxing, and Greco-Roman wrestling more than anything else, at least at the minor league level. And I found it odd that CBS would put on the most minor league fighter in the most minor league MMA league to promote their sport to the 18 to 34-year-old internet crowd.
You know, D. Will, you really have to work on being clear because it's really hard to figure out what your point of view is. I'm kidding. It's clear what you're talking about. All right, let's move on.
you had me there for a second,
sorry.
Tony.
I
was shocked.
Let's do a couple of quick hits here in the time that we have left. First, Justin, let's talk about what's going on with the Latino players and the Mets. That clubhouse is really in turmoil.
Well, it's funny what losing does. You know, a year ago, Sports Illustrated did a great feature on Omar Minaya and the diverse roster that he put together. Of their 40 men on the roster, 20 are of Latin American descent. And up until last week, the Mets, as many of you know, were struggling. Willie Randolph was in trouble of losing his job. And a few New York sports columnists, as you know, when teams lose in sports, they blame poor chemistry. That's something that they point to. And a couple of columnists pointed to the fact that some of the Latin players Didn't seem to be meshing well with the white American players. Phillip Bondy, he was taking account of how the guys were hanging out in the clubhouse. He made a point to point out that the Latin players were hanging out on one side, the white players were hanging out on another side. Also, Larry Brooks of the New York Post pointed out that there's a growing resentment among the some players on the Mets that not enough of the Latin players speak up to the media following games. Last year, Paul LaDuca, he said, believe me, some of these guys speak English. And he took issue with the fact that he was one of the only guys to step up and talk to the media. Billy Wagner, the team's closer, has a similar problem this year. And Larry Brooks of the Post went on to question whether or not they have too many Latin American ball players on the team.
He really said that?
He drew a comparison to the New York Rangers, the hockey team, and he brought up their collapse in the 2005-2006 season, and he asked, do they have too many Czechs on the team?
You know, somebody said that about having too many blacks on the team. People would go crazy, wouldn't they?
Absolutely. But, and, you know, I'm just wondering why this hasn't really caught fire. And actually, Omar Minaya, when he started his restructuring of the Mets, beginning with the signing of Pedro Martinez, and then he started to bring in guys like Carlos Delgado, Carlos Beltran, there was, on talk radio in New York, some folks were taking issue with the influx of Latino players being brought to the team.
Really? That's the story we're going to have to keep our eyes
on.
Yeah,
keep it, definitely.
Time is running out. I've only got about a minute for you, D. Will. I'm sorry about that. But Pac-Man Jones, you don't need a lot to explain that Pac-Man Jones coming back into the league is a very controversial situation.
Absolutely. I think it's more controversial in that it speaks to Roger Goodell's power, quote, power. Last year, as we know, Roger Goodell made a great show of his commissionership to the media and to the public at large. However, when Jerry Jones wanted to trade for Pac-Man Jones, he got him for a song, and suddenly there was Pac-Man Jones was reinstated, and there was no problem with his reinstatement. And it just goes to show that the NFL owners put Roger Goodell in that spot as commissioner, and they own him. He does not run the league. He is not autonomous, and what the owners want, the owners get.
Do you think that Pac-Man, last thing, I've got about 10 seconds or so for it.
Sure.
Do you think that Goodell is going to let Pac-Man Jones play with Dallas during the regular season this year?
Absolutely. As long as he stays out of trouble, Jerry Jones has a security guard with him right now at all times, off the field and on. And as long as he does okay off the field, Jerry Jones will report to Roger Goodell, and Roger Goodell will say, play on.
All right, we'll see. Justin Grant, D. Will, I want to thank you both very much for coming on.
Thanks a lot, Tony.
Thank you.
You can find more of D. Will's musings at the blog sportsonmymind.com. And Justin Grant oversees the sports world from his perch atop alphablogsports.blogspot.com.
And that was NPR's Tony Cox. And now it's letter time. Our editor, Sasha Woodruff, is here with me. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Fry. How are you?
I am fabulous and ready to tell everyone what folks shared with us this week. So we got a few letters about our Memorial Day coverage about the black men and women who've served in the United States throughout history. Michael Baker of Baltimore, Maryland, wrote us this. I was quite interested in our discussion of the invisible black veterans of World War II. He went on to say that he's tried to teach his children and grandchildren about the plight of the African and Japanese Americans who served during the Second World War. He continued, "To my mind, these two groups were the most loyal and courageous of all American soldiers in the war. They were fighting in a way to prove to whites they weren't just as good, they were better. And they were fighting for a country they were not sure would act like their country when the war was over."
We also got some letters about our segment discussing former press secretary Scott McClellan's book criticizing the current Bush administration. Michael Chanfrani in Green Lane, Pennsylvania, wrote us this. I was dismayed by some of the comments regarding Scott McClellan's book, and more specifically, its ramifications. He was accused by one of your guests as displaying a lack of candor. It seems that candor in the book is plentiful. The charge regarding a lack of loyalty begs the question, loyalty to whom? Scott is no longer the spokesperson for the administration.
We also got a lot of letters about our continuing coverage of how race has and will affect the presidential election. Sierra Andrade of Sacramento, California, heard our political coverage and is disappointed that our political analyst thought that race will sway voters in the general election. She wrote us this, "I must say that hearing that people will still base their decision on who they want to lead this country on race is very disappointing and disturbing. I feel that it is very sad that older generations are still thinking in that manner, because nowadays America needs fresh ideas, because where this country is now and heading to is based on old ideals which are not working.
And finally, listener Donna Harvey had a different take on one of our bloggers' roundtables. I find myself constantly yelling at the radio and fuming at the conversation taking place on the show. Why do you and your guests continue to throw all black people into one category as if we are a monolithic group? I'm a black woman with a degree working on a master's. I live in an upscale neighborhood, and my family income is in the upper six figures, and I am not an Obama supporter. I resent the fact that you and your guests never address the 10% of black folks that are not voting for Obama. And that's it for letters. Thank you for writing, and please keep your letters coming.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write to us.
And be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Thanks, Sasha.
Thanks, Fry.
That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, just because he's the presumptive nominee doesn't mean he'll be elected. Some African Americans are cautiously optimistic. Others don't think America's ready for a black president. And then there are those who don't support Barack Obama at all. We'll talk with people from different generations to find out what Obama's candidacy means to them. I'm Farai Chidea. This is News and Notes.